I believe, I know we have people here that would like to talk to us about this amendment. Yes.
That's what I have my notes here.
I have here a man by the name of Sevier?
Sewell.
Sewell. Mr. Sewell, would you like to talk to us about this? I know you've been here before, and if there's anyone else that would like to speak to us about this amendment, please be sure you've signed up. And Doug, are you gonna talk on this one?
No.
Terry, you're, okay, good.
I've got amendment 6 and 7, but I'm not.
Keep going, Doug, keep going. It's all on the bottom there, it's about the 4th or 5th last page of the file.
We'll start out by the camera giving us just a short review of the language in the bill that is different than what has been there, and then we will take other recommendations from people in the audience.
Madam Chairman, are we on amendment number 9?
Number 8.
Number 8.
And it has to do with developed.
Page 105 of the bill, line.
Do we have copies of the amendments 15. For the audience?
Yes, we have.
Yeah, okay, good.
Yes.
And so I understand we're on page 105, line 10, 105, line 10?
15. But his
that's a new material.
Okay, so actually the staff has recommended that we delete the material, and we need to know where it came from, and then we'll discuss why it should be in there, or I understand that the witness here would even like stronger language, and we'll discuss why staff feels that it shouldn't be there, and then we'll.
Okay. Madam Chair and members of the committee, you asked me to give you a brief overview of this particular section, and it is one that I'm probably least qualified to speak on than anybody, because this language never originated from our office, nor have I ever been asked to consider it from a legal point of view or to attempt to figure out what it actually does as a legal matter. It was added to the bill during the end of the last session as a floor amendment, and it was incorporated word for word. I'm really not sure where it came from, but my understanding is that it is attempting to define a federal provision in ANCSA under state law. It's using state law as a vehicle to define a term that is used in federal law, which grants a tax exemption to certain ANCSA lands. And I really am not sure what the effect of the particular provision would be if the committee chooses to leave it in this bill.
Okay. Terry, I see that you said that you're not going to testify, but are you prepared to at least advise
sure.
the committee? Would you sit up at the table in one of the empty chairs, and then if one of the other people come, we'll ask.
Madam Chairman, I'm Terry Early from the Department of Community and Regional Affairs, and at this point, by the people I work for, I've been instructed that are not taking a position, but mm-hmm. I can give some background as to how this came about. During the last session of the legislature, there was some discussion about the term developed as it was in ANCSA and what the state ought to do about trying to come up with a definition that could be applied in all the municipalities. Currently, each municipal assessor is required to figure out what he thinks that term developed means in the federal statute. So we've got each one of them doing that. So we've got 15 or 16 different assessors coming up with their own definition for developed. The Department of Community and Regional Affairs at that time met with representatives of the Native organizations, Native corporations, to work on language. There was some consensus language that was almost identical to what this was that came from the department and the native corporations, and was introduced as a separate bill in the last legislative session. When those things were put together on the floor, this was added in along with some additional language that dealt with timber as far as the term developed was concerned, that was actually added to the bill on the floor, and that was part of the reason, I understand, for the veto. So basically, this language was developed as a consensus from the previous administration and the native corporations.
You don't remember what amendment number was that was?
No, I don't.
Was it 17? I'll find out how it goes on. I gotta find, what's the number of the bill?
Are there any questions for Mr. Early from the committee? If there are no questions from the committee, then...
His recommendation is declared to remove this?
He's not making a recommendation at all. Mr. Early is not here to take a position. It is our staff's recommendation, and I might say that that only comes because we have worked from the philosophy that there are a lot of major changes that individual people and groups of people would like to make to this bill. But we have tried to keep out of this bill things that might jeopardize it, things that are controversial. And we have tried to get people to put those things in separate legislation. And so that's where that, not that we're opposed to this at all, we're just opposed to jeopardizing this bill. And now we'll, yes, Mr. Chairman.
Madam Chairman, if I might, there is a Senate bill currently in Senate Finance, Senate Bill 260. It has the exact same language as the developed that's in here.
Right, thank you. So we don't have to jeopardize the bill. There are people here that I think that will tell us that they would prefer it in this bill. We're going to hear from them next. Okay. Okay, we'll hear from you. If you state your name and business for the
rest of the day. Thanks, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Kellis Sewell with Cape Fox Corporation. First of all, I'd like to clarify what both people have said here. The language on developed was passed out of both the Senate and the House committees as an amendment to the language. It was not an amendment. The specific language on undeveloped was not an amendment on the floor. The amendment on the floor was very complicated because it was another bill that procedurally they had supplanted the original version that came out of the House Finance Committee. The amendments on the floor that we're talking about in here were those that were done in the House. The original developed language is in all versions of both House and Senate bills as it came out of the original committees as amended. The specific amendment that was controversial was the amendment on the floor to exempt forest language or forest land from coverage for taxation under municipal taxing provisions. Now the basic logic for that is because we as timber owners felt that forest resources, since once they're cut, they're extinguished for some 100 years before they grow back, should not be taxed on any basis other than as a severance tax, which is the way every other state taxes forest property does it. So that's primarily the reason for exempting forest land from municipal taxation. It should be a state program of taxation. Now that's Kate Fox's opinion.
Well, I understand that. It's the opinion of a lot of people, but the amendment was reported written that anyone that had a tree in their yard could conceivably get off without having to pay taxes. And
well, that's debatable, I guess. Yeah. But anyway, I just
debatable wanted, enough that the governor vetoed
it. Well, that's another thing I wanted to say too. There was also another amendment that was on the floor related to revenue sharing at the North Slope Borough, and it could have been. I didn't talk to the governor or the administration about it, but it could have been that. That may have led to a veto just as much as a forced language.
Kind of hesitate to think so when he turns right around and implements emergency regulations to take care of the revenue share.
Well, it could be. I don't know.
Makes you wonder anyway. Okay, would you go ahead and defend your amendment and tell us what you would prefer?
Okay, so what I would prefer is that the language not be tampered with because it was constructed with Native Corporation land managers and the community and regional affairs people in attendance. What we would prefer doing is we found some inequities in the language after we after it went through both houses last year. And these, as we would conceive them, are primarily housekeeping amendments. The First Amendment would treat would amend the developed language so that until property is considered in productive present use and gainful, should it be taxed. I think you'll see through research, and I have some letters, for example, in support of this, from Katz, who was there in attendance when the NAILCO provisions were being debated in Congress, and that is that the private landowner should be given the opportunity, well, they should not be taxed until there's an income stream. In other words, until the property is not only developed, but it produces an income stream. So that's why we're very adamant that it should not only just be productive present use, but the word R should be changed to N. And another way to look at it is you could almost do anything on our land that could be considered productive present use. For example, I'm using this as an exaggerated example, okay, but even if you cut trees, which is what we do, and allow people to purchase those trees or even cut it themselves for firewood, and they pay us a nominal amount, maybe $10 or $20, whatever, that could be considered productive present use in game. Or game, depending on how you look at it.
Okay. We have one for Representative Tischer and then Representative Clarkson.
Tell me, Mr. Sewell, if I have a piece of property, which I do have, it's non-productive property, it's just sitting there, and I've been paying taxes on it ever since taxes came into being. Why am I different and may be taxed in that regard, whether it, and it is not productive, it isn't even something you cut wood on, why should I pay taxes on that and your folks not?
Well, I'll answer that in two ways. One, because Native corporations were treated differently under the Federal Act. They were given an exemption for 20 years from taxation until they could get into the income stream and make money, is what it boils down to. They weren't a productive member of society.
Nobody figured that out when I didn't have any money.
Well,
I'm trying to say here, I think, that if it's good for one, it should be good for the other. And if there is property that would fall under the same interpretation that my non-productive property is, and I have no more money than the natives do, why should I not be exempt then also?
Well, the only way I can answer that is just that we have, you and I and everybody at this table, have probably had more opportunity to make money than what was agreed to that Congress, the Native corporations did. And let me answer the second, let me give you the second part of that answer. Where is your property located? Does it have any services provided to it or not?
Not.
So that was another feeling we had. We're not getting any services whatsoever from our property as well.
Whatever services are provided, I have to provide them.
Mm-hmm. Well, my only answer to that is to fall back on the logic that originally Congress enacted in the law, and that is that the private landowner, community corporations, were to be given a tax exemption. And we can argue that you and I should be given exemptions as well. But that wasn't the philosophy that Congress made 20 years.
Representative
Foster? Well, I'm a little confused here. We've started out with the person advocating a change to the existing language, and as I understand, there's also a proposal to delete the existing language. I just want to make sure where exactly we are.
Okay, the proposal from staff is Amendment Number 8, and it would delete materials that have been included on this page that allow for the idea of development that these people are talking to us about. However, the witness is saying that he would either prefer that we not delete the language or even improve on it. And so that's kind of what's before us. I know it's a little confusing.
So we have three choices before us, basically. One is to eliminate M entirely, leaving no definition of the word developed in the Settlement Act.
That is Amendment Number 8, and so that really is your only choice at this time. But the witness that is here is trying to defend not deleting number eight.
Right.
And then, of course, if we don't, hoping that he'll be able to get us to improve on the language, and I imagine we'll present us then with a new amendment. Is that not correct?
Well, it's in the book. That's where I'm confused. It's in our file, I think,
with
his proposed amendment. That's what I'm trying to figure out. First alternative
is
to delete M and do nothing to the word developed in the Settlement Act.
That's correct.
The second alternative is to leave M in unchanged, which provides one definition of the provision in the Settlement Act. And are we going to hear some testimony on whether or not the staff analysis is correct with regard to the impact of the existing language in the bill? And I'm inserting a question, but let me finish. The third alternative then is leaving M in with the Cape Fox Amendment, right? Just trying to get clear in my mind what our choices are.
Okay, there is some backup in your packet.
depends on, I think, an economic analysis.
Maybe I could ask you. In a normal situation where it's just regular private property, and you do those same things, clear the timber, you put in the utilities, you put in the roads, start collecting some money for utility service, I don't know how that would work. At what level is that land then normally taxed by a municipality?
If it's to the point where the lots are saleable, then it would be taxed at the value of those lots.
Saleable, not sold.
Not sold.
Well, fair market value.
Fair market value.
Plus the fact that you handle real estate development different than you have timber for economic purposes and for purposes of this act.
Okay, are there any further questions from this witness? And then we have another one very anxious to share with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roger Lang, and I've had a little experience managing native lands and native affairs for the past few years. And this is an interesting part of it, because I think, well, the staff recommendation might consider this controversial. The deletion of this one paragraph would make the bill so controversial on our side that it then becomes a red flag piece of legislation. For instance,
I would like to say that the reason why we consider it controversial is it is not now in state law.
I know.
And that's what we try to stay away from.
I know.
Okay.
And it's not there is what we consider controversial. So there are two sides to the political question. For instance, this thing does not preserve a tax-exempt status for native lands. This defines when it comes out of that tax-exempt status. There's a philosophical difference between what the discussion has been so far and about what the realities are. And I speak for GoBelt Corporation, which is the local native corporation here in the Juneau Douglas area, who has selected lands for both for economical purposes, both for real estate development and for timber development. And those are apples and oranges as far as the economics of how you deal with lands are. Other provisions of this act allow the creation of special taxing districts where there are no people. GoBelt owns lands on the south side of Douglas Island with an extension of North Douglas Road. So does the borough. There could be some interesting real estate development areas in that portion of this land that are discussed by this and apply. Now, I would wish that you all had federally taxed exempt lands when you all began your land holdings, but it didn't happen. It happened to us, and it happened for a reason. It happened because Congress didn't want to create preserves or reserves of eternally tax-exempt lands in the state. And the native community agreed to that. And we still agree to that. It's not our presumption nor our need to eternally ask you for a tax exempt. We're not asking you for that. What we are asking is that when it comes out of that, it be very clearly defined. And that definition is very important to us, because we have taken ill-defined pieces of native legislation in the same act and spent as much as 8 years in court fighting through the law system areas that we think are very important. This is one of them. This is not a wholesale blanket coverage of native lands. There are probably 9 or 10 native organizations that will be affected by this. Mostly when you do this, it's not that big a problem, okay? There are some village corporations in Southeast, I think two. I think Kootenai is one. I think a couple in the Kodiak area. There are very few regional corporations whose lands will be affected by this type of legislation, but who hold a very dear interest in what's happening in this thing. My suggestion, and the people that I represent, would advocate the retention of the language, and in section one under M, remove the or and put the and. We would do that, and that would, in our minds, be a workable piece of language. There are other sections of law that deal with public utility easements, with rights of ways, with those kinds of things. And those laws make a lot of sense. And basically, we've not come to too many problems with them. This one, however, removes the exemption for native lands from taxation. And it's something that we would want very clearly defined so that we don't spend 8 years fighting every borough, every city that's directly affected, and not pay taxes while we're in court.
Does Senate Bill 260 solve your problem?
Yes, except for one amendment.
Thank you. Questions for the witness? Representative
Fry. Well, if I'm understanding, your amendment then is to change or to and that's it?
That's it. In this present bill as printed, under section A. And retention of that section, which is another battle because other people are saying we delete the section.
Any other questions?
Well,
Reverend Foster.
In the situation on the west side of Douglas, you say Gold Belt has land there that is at least interested in turning into a subdivision, developing a subdivision.
Well, that land wasn't selected for timber purposes. Let's put it that way.
For what?
For timber purposes.
Right. Okay.
Because the assumption is that every land that natives have selected in Southeast was there to cut timber. That's not true. There are lands that are selected for it.
You also said there was some municipal land over there?
Yes.
And the municipality of Juneau is thinking of developing that?
It's
a subdivision?
Yeah, it's in phase one.
Yeah. Are they in tandem with the road?
Yes, they are, and they're in tandem with selections.
Are they adjacent?
The community of Juneau and Gold Belt Corporation selected lands abutting and adjacent to each other so that it would free significant acreage from the Forest Service.
Assume the road, a road is into it.
Uh-huh. And assume, no road.
Assume.
Yeah.
Assume a road is into both parcels. Assume utilities are into both parcels. They've been surveyed. Lots have been lined out. What is the taxing situation right now with municipal land versus native land?
I have no idea.
What is the situation, taxing situation now with native land?
Taxing situation is there are no improvements, there are no lines, there are no roads. It is exempt.
No. I'm saying assume that the road's there, the utilities are there, it's been cleared, the lines have been surveyed.
And that doesn't happen by accident.
No. That's the question. The question is, then is that now taxable under...
Yes. Under the subdivision laws of the Juneau Borough, yes, I would imagine. Yeah.
Would the municipality's land, I don't understand what happens to municipality land when it sells it for a subdivision. Would it be taxable?
If it goes into private ownership.
Providing it went into any kind of private ownership, it would become taxable. As long as the borough owns it, they can't tax themselves.
Well, if I can follow up, what at the point that it's got a road, I don't know much about this stuff, at the point that it's got a road and it's got utilities into it and it's been cleared and the lots have been surveyed, is it in private ownership? Have they already sold it to someone that did
that? Not necessarily.
The municipality could do all that and hold the land as municipal land. And if it's municipal land at that point, no lot sold, it would be tax exempt.
Right. The municipality would not tax itself.
So the one lot, exactly the same improvements, one of the subdivisions is native owned and taxed, the one right next to it is municipally owned and not taxed.
Mm-hmm. Could be.
Could be. That's possible. I think as a general rule, most of our municipalities at this point in time, if they can find a developer who will do it, they let private enterprise do it. The cases where
do it meaning
develop
the land,
yeah,
survey,
they sell it to the developer and let them take care of that kind of thing. But in cases where they can't find a developer who's willing to put up the front money to do that, then the municipalities are in fact providing their own subdivision.
What is, if I can ask, what's the more normal situation for a municipality?
To sell it to somebody else.
Sells it unimproved.
And it immediately becomes private property. And
then it's taxed.
Immediately. Mm-hmm.
So then, hypothetical, if that were the case, it would be native land with a road, utilities, mm-hmm. surveyed, and taxed, and private land with road, utilities, surveyed, and taxed.
Taxed before the development.
Right. Both taxed at the
right.
same time under present
no.
law.
The native land is not taxed until it's developed.
Development would remove the taxation exemption on native land.
I thought what you said is putting in a road, putting in utilities, clearing it, and surveying
that's
it
right.
would constitute development.
I
if that's what you want to change. You
no.
want to say that those things do not constitute development? Is
no,
that
they
what
do
you're
constitute. And we don't argue with it. They do constitute it, and we won't argue with that, in the subdivision steps. It might not do it in the timber development steps, okay? You might build a road 7 years before you cut one tree in the stand of timber. You don't do that when you do real estate. That's
well,
different.
Now you got me confused. I posed
I
a hypothetical under existing law.
Uh-huh.
Under existing law, you said the municipality would tax that.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
What does this change?
Does it change?
The problem that I have from the discussion with mm-hmm. the assessors is at what point in that development stage does it become
mm-hmm.
developed under the term that's in the federal statute? Is it when they first put in the roads, but there's still some utilities not there? Or is it not up until the point is ready for sale or until after sale? And this language, at least from what the assessors, the way they're reading it currently, the Assessors Association, says that at the time that it becomes totally ready for sale, then it's taxed, but not until. And they think that's the way that it reads, but they're not real positive. In fact, part of their concern only is that this is not that much clearer than what we've already got. That if you're going to draw the line, draw it real black and white so that everybody knows where everybody stands. I don't think the Assessors Association is opposed to the language from the standpoint of the legislature drawing the line for them, but only they want it to be as clear as absolutely possible, mm-hmm. and they don't feel this language is.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
You know where this bill came from, don't you?
Now, let me go back to something.
Representative Fritz.
You were putting an and instead of an or. Is that line 5 on page 106?
No sense putting an and instead of an or is the language that's not
15 on page 105.
Line 15. Isn't it?
Yeah, it's line 15.
Okay, I got it.
Are there any more questions for the witness?
This section here.
Do you have any questions for this witness?
No, but I do.
Okay, I'm going to go.
Well,
okay.
He's finished as far as I know.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Oh, he's a patient of mine, too. Do you know that?
All right.
One of those that pulled through.
a success story, right?
Representative Phillips, would you like to speak to one?
Was this language in this particular section in last year's bill?
It was in some versions of last year's bill and then deleted, but
the
version
floor.
That hit the floor did not have it in it. My recollection is that it was reintroduced as an amendment at that point. And I checked the amendment package and it's published as an amendment and assigned an official amendment number. So
that was number 17?
I believe it was 17.
Okay, I'm
sorry, the other witness just said the opposite.
I know that. Yes. Mr. Early, please.
If I might, Madam Chairman, the language was added in the Finance Committee, but when it finally came to the floor, it was the Judiciary Committee version that was on the floor.
Oh,
So it was added by a committee, but it had to be added again on the floor as an amendment.
So it was in and out, so it's understandable that the witness who's here would have been confused. Thank you. Any more questions? Is it clear in your mind? Apparently it was not in the original bill that was produced by the municipal league and other people. It was introduced in one of the committees, taken out of the bill before it hit the floor in the last committee of referral, or at least one of the last committees of referral, and then introduced to the bill as an amendment, probably amendment number 17. And did pass the floor, and was in the bill when it was needed.
I checked the higher board.
Watch my lips when I'm talking.
Well, I can hear you.
Would you like to?
Yes.
Madam Chairman, my name is Tony Strong. I'm here to speak on behalf of the Alaska Corporation.
Okay.
I'd like to, without going through the whole analysis that the committee seems to want to go through with these languages here, I'd like to state that Sea Alaska is in support of what Cape Fox Corporation is trying to achieve here. At the same time, we'd like to see it done this year rather than having it done in some separate legislation. The comments that were made by Cape Fox were in support of as well.
How would this legislation pertain to Sea Alaska?
It's on the same level at Cape Fox, that we do hold some properties that, if this definition were to be adopted, would lend some confusion. They'd probably end us up in court with trying to define what develop means. I think just by having a few simple modifications, it would be able to eliminate a lot of controversy a little bit later on.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. You're talking about property in populated areas such as Juneau or Anchorage, or are you talking about remote areas?
More remote areas. With Juneau, Sea Alaska does not own any. Area. We're not talking. I don't think that we're talking about.
We would like to state that there we have some letters from municipalities that do have native holdings that are now being taxed that they feel would be out from under the taxing authority with this bill if it's going as it is.
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying to us that most of your property in more remote areas than Juneau. That doesn't help too much.
Yeah.
There's most of it where it might be taxed if it were not for this.
No, it won't be affecting most of Sea Alaska's lands, but we want to avoid the controversy in the points where our lands are affected.
So basically you are saying what Cape Fox is saying, that number one, you don't want the language removed, you'd even like it improved so it was more clear.
That's correct.
Thank you. Any more questions for the witness?
Thank you.
I do need your address. Okay, is there anyone else to speak on this proposed amendment? Thank you. Lisa up here from the municipality of Juneau.
Madam Chairman, I'm Lee Sharp. I'm the attorney for the City and Borough of Juneau. Let me speak not on behalf of the city, but more as an attorney who's going to be trying to tell his assessor what this means or what ANILCA means.
Mm-hmm.
I hope I don't offend anybody in the room, but the language in the Federal Act is very poorly drafted.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to be clarified. The first question I have, which I don't know if the committee has asked to have answered or not, is whether the state has the authority to define what the federal statute means. That seems to me to be a federal question. If indeed we did wind up in court, either under whatever develop means in the act or whatever develop means here as you're trying to define it, one of the defenses I think which any municipality would use is that what you have in Title 29 is irrelevant, because only the feds can define what they mean by federal statute or the federal courts. That's an argument that I'm sure would be raised. I agree with the prior speakers. We need something to clarify what that act means. Whether we have the authority to do it or not, I don't know. But certainly we don't have any bright line that we can put down and know whether the property is taxable or not. Unfortunately, this to me is more confusing than what's in the federal act. Because we go in here, we say there are certain things which usually mean developed, but which don't mean developed in this context. It looks to me like we're describing a subdivision process here. We say surveying, construction of roads, and providing utilities and other similar actions normally considered component parts of development don't mean that here. You put all, what does that mean? Individually? Does that mean constructing a road by itself doesn't mean that it's developed? But that if you put all three of these things together, it might be developed. I think we have as much confusion here as we're trying to eliminate. The idea, and I must admit that ANILCA certainly leads one to the conclusion that this might be a legitimate approach, the property is going to be developed and undeveloped. In other words, it ceases to be developed at some point and it goes off the tax rolls. Now, I think you can appreciate the problem that's going to create for assessors. In the middle of an assessment year, it suddenly becomes, according to the owner, undeveloped. What happens at that point? It was assessable on the tax day, which is January 1st, but it becomes undeveloped in the middle of the year, and therefore tax exempt. Does that mean that we cannot foreclose on it for the taxes that were supposedly levied for January 1st? I don't know. I don't know whether we can address that or whether it's been addressed at all. But the problem of whether or not it has really become undeveloped, again, is going to be a question that we're all going to be arguing about, unfortunately. Now, as I say, that may be a problem with ANILCA, because it certainly leads one to the idea of conclusion that that's what they were thinking about with Vasily. The amendments that were proposed by Kate Fox, as I understand it, would go so far as to say we're not just talking about develop, but we're talking about profit making. In other words, there's got to be a net income stream. That means that each year at some time we're going to have to examine the profit and loss statements of the corporation. And I don't know whether you can focus down on the profit and loss of that property. In other words, generally, I don't think corporations isolate each individual property they own for the purpose of determining whether they made money or lost money on that property. It's all of their holdings. So that concept, I suggest to you, is going to create more problems. The other amendment that's been suggested, that you change or to and, I think has the effect of moving the line further from just pure developed. The property has to be gainful, in a condition of gainful and productive present use. There was testimony earlier that others understood that if it were subdivided and ready for sale, it would be taxable. At least that's what I understood. I don't know if that's what this says. And if you change this to gainful and productive, I think clearly that subdivided but unsold would not be developed under this definition. Another problem, which also has its origins in ANILCA and is reflected in here, that the property which is going to be taxed, it will be limited to the smallest practical tract of property actually used in the developed state. If we had, say, a 100-acre tract, that is, a U.S. survey, whatever, of 100 acres, and the owner goes in and develops a one-acre tract, a one-acre part of it, but doesn't subdivide it. He puts in a commercial building, leases it to somebody else, and they go into operation. Everybody agrees that's developed. What is it we're going to tax? We're going to tax that 1 acre, acre and a half, and we have to decide what the smallest practicable tract is. Suppose they don't pay the, that's one problem. Suppose they don't pay the taxes, and here's where the real problem comes. What do we foreclose on? If we're only taxing that one small tract, one would think we foreclose on that one small tract, but it does not exist as a legal lot. It has not been subdivided. The only thing we can foreclose on is the entire 100-acre tract. And let's say that's a problem with ANILCA, because it has this concept of the smallest fractional tract. You can't foreclose on something that doesn't exist. Otherwise, the process of foreclosure operates as a subdivision. You carve that out as a separate parcel and foreclose on it. And that's what you do when you subdivide. You carve out the tracts of property. You create new parcels. So there are a number of problems both in the proposed legislation and in ANILCA. And I think, quite frankly, that I'm going to have more trouble telling my assessor what this proposed language means than if we were to leave it open. So I agree something needs to be done to clarify. I really don't think this clarifies it that much. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Sharp? Representative McBride?
What would be your suggestion? let's put it a little easier.
Well,
I think maybe Mr. McBride, what we should do, and we will when everyone is through, is to delete this section and then ask the supporters, based on what they've heard here today, to bring the clearest, best language, and then at that time address that, whether or not we want to insert it into the bill. And I think there's no one here except the people that are afraid of maybe losing the whole issue that have agreed that they could settle for what's here. I mean, even the people that wrote the bill are not happy with the language.
Well, could I ask another question?
Based on that.
What if we broke these two words apart, gainful and productive, what in your mind as an attorney is gainful? Should that
to me indicates that there's some sort of income.
It doesn't necessarily mean profitable income, does it?
No. That could certainly be argued, though. What we gain is what we net. And as I say, I'm not sure how clear even what we have in here is.
It appears to me that the word gainful is a questionable word. Am I right in thinking that way?
Madam Chairman, I would agree with the representative that that's another word that in itself might be the subject of definition in here, so we know what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Here's an example of something. A corporation owns property, builds a building on it for its own use, for an office or something. Is that gainfully employed? What happens if they lease that property to somebody else with the requirement that they build a building on it, and at the end of the 10-year lease, the building is to become the property of the native corporation? The lease is terminated, and therefore, under this definition, it's no longer developed land. And the corporation begins to use the building for its own private purposes. Is that developed? Certainly, I think most of us think when you put a building online, it's developed. But there'd certainly be a question under this language as to whether that's developed. But you're correct. What do we mean by gainful? It certainly could mean we have a net return. We have some definite income, and we have a net return.
In some of these words here, surveying construction roads, providing utilities. Is providing utilities as simple to you as water and sewer, power line, or the thing I'm thinking about is, again, in timberland, sometimes scrap timber is used for firewood. Is that providing any utilities in any way you could think of?
Madam Chairman? If my assessor were to put that question to me, my gut reaction is that no, that would not be a utility. The only stretch of the imagination would be that somebody goes out, cuts it up for firewood, and then distributes it as an energy source. That might, by a remote stretch, be considered a utility. But I think we're talking about installing some sort of facility on the land.
Well, to change your example around just a little bit, what if you then say we have some down timber up there that isn't good for lumber or some usage like that, and it's available to you as firewood. Now, you haven't distributed it, but you've made it available. Does that change what your thought is?
Now, they talk about, in this definition, a purposeful modification. That, I think, would probably take care of what you're talking about. Dead or down is some purposeful modification aimed at making it productive. Merely thinning out the dead or diseased trees, even cutting dead or diseased trees, probably wouldn't rise to that dignity.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Sharp? Thank you, Mr. Sharp. Is there anyone else that would like to speak on this amendment at this time? Thank you. Jane, would you come forward?
Yes. Madam Chairman, all I would do is, if you want, is give you an update on what's happening on the Senate side.
Yes, that would be nice if we knew that even.
Jenny Chit with Alaska Municipal League. Mm-hmm. The Senate CRA waived referral of Senate Bill 260, which is this language, and it's now in Senate Finance. And representatives of the Assessors Association and the Native Corporations are working together to come up with language that has a clearer definition, because there seems to be general consensus that although this bill attempts to define developed, it doesn't do it in a way that solves the problem.
It would be my intention at this time, if there are no further witnesses, to accept an amendment, or to accept a motion to accept amendment number 8, which literally deletes this language. I would also ask the staff then, if in Senate Bill 260 there is language that is agreed to by all parties, that they bring it forward for our consideration. But in no way is that a commitment to insert it into this bill. We would treat it as an amendment and vote on it, just like we're doing it. I think there's no question that what we have here is no good. Thank you. Representative McBride and then Fisher.
I just wanted to say, could your motion or be to accept the deletion amendment subject to getting improved language?
I would prefer not to do that. I mean, I would bring that amendment to you if they come up with it. But I don't think that without it, I would want to commit myself, and I don't think anyone else wants to hear either. And that's kind of what we're saying. We're saying we won't take this out unless we have something that does it better. And what we have here is an amendment to take it out or leave it in. That's what we have before us. And without the better, I wouldn't want to stretch that motion. Representative Dishman?
Madam Chairman, I agree with your statement, and therefore I'd like to make a motion to accept amendment number 8, which would be deleting lines 10 on page 105 through line 7 of page 106. And ask for you to
amend. Is there objection, Representative Brown?
For a question here, first, line 10 is all. Let's see, let me read it.
It is a conceptual motion that relates back to Amendment 8, so don't hold it to the exact word where it starts and word where it ends. Tam is the answer.
Madam Chairman, I need to clarify my motion. Line 10 on page 105 starts subsection M, and that subsection M leads to subsection 1. If you don't delete subsection M, subsection 1 makes no sense. So you have to delete all of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it would go through line 7 on page 6. Which would be through subsection M within North, not including line 7. It would be through line 7 if that wasn't made clear.
Thank you.
And for justification purposes, to commit this committee to awaiting an intangible that may never surface, I would prefer to delete that section, which is under question. And should we receive anything, we would treat it as another amendment at any time, but just like any other amendment on page 2 or 17 or 39.
But it is my intent to not move the bill out until all amendments that have been proposed by the interested parties are at least reviewed by these committees and either accepted or rejected.
Madam Chairman, if I might, I would just like to say that it's probably easier to delete a section than it is to get another section back in. And for the people who are interested, I would just hate to see them not have that opportunity from this committee.
They will have that opportunity. I can tell you that because this amendment could be somewhat controversial, it was not in the original bill. So somewhere along the line, it gained enough credibility to get in here. So I suspect, you know, that same sort of logic will work when the better language comes. And yes, I can say to you, everything is right. Is your objection still maintained?
I'll drop it.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. The motion has been made, and I won't repeat it. But it is that we accept Amendment Number 8. It's been made by Representative Fisher, and there's no further objection. We'll so move. I don't know if people from Cape Fox are staying on top of that Senate bill or if you're working on it, but we do want to move this bill as soon as possible. So as soon as you have the language that you think is perfected, please bring it in that form to our committee, and we'll ahead of time as possible, and then we'll get before the committee, okay? Thank you. Okay? We should do this. Okay. Now, we have, I know, at least another witness that would like to speak to us today. Now, he does not have the amendment prepared, but he also will speak to today and then bring it to us.
The same bill?
No, in the same bill, in another form. Lindsay's here, we'll go ahead.
Thank you, Representative Walker. I'm Dave Hutchins, Executive Director of the Alaska Rural Electric Co-op Association. And what I do have with me are the amendments to the Senate bill that were adopted. And my proposal is that the language in this House bill be made the same as the language relating to utilities in the Senate bill.
So it would be a new section that you would propose be inserted where?
Well, let me just distribute these, if I may. I think you probably already have it. Yeah.
I think everyone's got a copy.
I was surprised that they apparently didn't have it. Yeah. But
I might tell you that any amendment that have been approved to the Senate bill that I have been told is never going to move are not automatically added to this bill. So please bring them forward if there's anyone in the audience. Since that bill's not going anywhere, we don't need to.
Well, I understand that, and that's why I'm here to submit the same amendments here that were adopted over there.
By the CNRA committee.
By the CNRA committee in the Senate. The amendment number one, this is divided up into two separate amendments over there. Amendment number one was a carefully crafted compromise that grew out of a great deal of work by a municipal attorney, a utility attorney, and a member of the Public Utilities Commission. And Mr. Sharp was the municipal attorney that was involved in that. I don't know if he's still here or not. He's just outside the door, and I'm sure that he'll be able to give you some detailed information about what went on in that work and more detail as to the background for that.
Okay, for the committee's clarification, you can draw a line through page 33, line 27. Don't let that make sure. We'll just get right to the meat. That's right. That line 33... All right, page 33, line 27 refers to a different bill. Doesn't it? We'll ignore that part. Yeah, don't draw your line. He's just putting forward an amendment, and at a later time we'll decide where it goes in the
bill. I think it does happen to be line page 33, but a different line, perhaps.
Okay, well.
I think it's line 28 on page 33. It's
Okay.
And in each case, it's on the same page, but the line will be different.
Okay, good. We need to keep that clear.
Ma'am?
Yes.
Could you please explain what 2935060 says then? No, it's a franchise and permit, so what does that mean?
Okay, what this does is to insert this citation into the section of the code that restricts the what the home rule municipalities can do. It refers, it's cross-reference there to make this section apply to home rule municipalities. The heart of the matter is when you get down here to the part, says section 2935070, and then the rest of it is basically necessary to make it all fit together. The intent of what was done here with section 070, one thing was it was honoring the decision that was made by the legislature in 1980 that certain utilities would be exempted from regulation by the EPUC, and without this kind of change, they would now, when this bill passes, would now become regulated or subject to regulation by the local municipality. And in the case of the electric and telephone co-ops, they're member-owned, and the deregulation is accomplished only by a vote of their members. And it was felt that they were able to manage their own affairs in the interest of their members as the consumer-owned utilities. And it's felt that why should they be regulated by some other entity, whether it's APUC or the local municipality, if their members choose to be deregulated? And there are others in that same category that are deregulated that would become subject to local municipal regulation. Frankly, if we're going to be regulated, we'd much prefer to be regulated by the APUC, where we feel that there's a body of expertise that's been developed through the years. And that we think it's appropriate that this option be available for these consumer-owned utilities to opt out from under regulation if they choose, if their members choose. There have been several elections around the state to try this out. The electric and telephone cooperatives at Cordova are now exempt from regulation. The electric cooperative at NACNEC is now exempt. And there was an election at Matanuska Electric which failed, and so they're still regulated. Another provision of this Senate language was to make it clear that the APUC would retain jurisdiction to settle disputes between municipalities and certificated utilities. When there has to be someone above the two of them that can settle these disputes, and the EPUC is the one that's given that responsibility. This down at the bottom of page two is something dealing specifically with the cable TV, including the cable TV people, but it also includes us. Those exemptions from in 7-Eleven are, one of them is for the opt-out provision for electric co-ops, another is for cable TV. Say, Mr. Sharp, I'm sure will be able to give you more detail about this. There was intense interest before that committee in this amendment number one, but by the time it came up for final decision, it was completely non-controversial. It seemed to be worked out by all parties. Now, amendment number two was a bit more controversial. I was on one side, Mr. Sharp was on the other on this particular amendment. And what amendment number two does is to retain the existing law exactly as it is in regard to the extraterritorial powers of a municipal utility system. And the difference between what this does and what the present bill does is it retains the language here that the municipal utility system can expand beyond its own borders to adjacent areas. The present bill simply leaves it open for them to go hopscotching around anywhere they choose. And we think it's appropriate to retain this in here if they can expand into adjacent areas. And that's what they do. We can debate it further, I'm sure, as there more discussion evolves.
Tell us why you care.
Well, the there have been a lot of fights between utilities of various kinds, neighboring utilities of whatever kind, through the years. Some years back, there was a very bitter fight between the municipal utility system in Anchorage and the Chugach Electric. And in fact, it's not completely over yet, although it has been in the Supreme Court once. And we feel that this language that's in the statute now has been tested, and we'd like to maintain it. We have a feel for what this is, and we'd not like to reopen old wounds and go back to those fights. We want to try to get those territorial fights behind us.
Representative Fry.
Well, I'm sure that there's a lot of things here that I don't understand. And I do understand that there's vast differences between various public utilities around the state. So I guess, and I hope I'm not boring the committee or anybody here, but I'd like to address this as I know about my own particular community, which is Ketchikan. The city of Ketchikan owns a utility. There is a board, a utility board, but it's more or less advisory, and the city council makes decisions, the final decisions on all these things that are mentioned here, for one thing, on the rates and how the rates will be set up and all those things. Then, now I can extend that to very possibly there will be in the future several municipalities, which would be Petersburg, Wrangell, and Ketchikan, would be extending, would be using mutual power, and very possibly someday Juneau may even be involved in that, Cake, several communities. And part of that picture may very well be, and when you talk about your amendment number two, extending the utilities to borax, because they're going to be in need in power, and we'll have, under certain circumstances, excess power. So I guess I'm asking a whole bunch of questions here. One of amendment number two is it wouldn't be anything adjacent at all, so because it's 35 miles away, and it's even out of the boundaries of the borough and everything else. The other thing is how this might relate to being the city of Ketchikan owns the utilities, and the borough and they have customers in the borough. It seems to me like some of these things here would be confusing to our particular situation.
In regard to the specific instance that you raised there about extending service to the borax mine, I think that when you're expanding beyond your borders like that, and you're not going past some other existing utility, you're the closest one to the area, I would think that would be adjacent. It's when you're jumping past the territory assigned to some other utility, and getting on their border on the other side of their service area. That's where you get the problems of checkerboard type of service areas. And, my office is on Fireweed Lane in Anchorage, and it really is a checkerboard. There's a pole out in front of our office that blocks my window, but we don't get service from that. That's the other one, the other company. You know, it's really a mess, and that's the kind of thing that we're trying to get away from, and we've made progress in the last few years in getting away from it. And I really don't think this would cause any problems for Ketchikan in extending out to serve Borax if they choose to do so.
The other thing is that the city of Ketchikan, for reasons that you may know but I don't know, isn't, I believe, regulated by APUC.
That's correct. They are not regulated by APUC. As a matter of fact, the Anchorage Municipal Light and Power is the only municipal system in the state of Alaska that is regulated by APUC. I believe the statute provides that they will be regulated until there is an absence of competition. When there's competition, you're regulated. When there's no competition, you're not regulated. So the isolated systems that you have everywhere else, and I'm not sure that makes any sense, but that's what it says.
Now, this is the way it works in our community.
What?
That is the way it works in our community. Our community, there's no competition, and they are regulated.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The municipal owned. They're certificated.
Oh, only on municipal owned. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying.
Oh, okay.
On,
I thought you were talking about utilities.
No, municipally owned utility systems.
Oh.
That.
Well, then it makes sense.
Whatever.
Otherwise, they would be competition. Maybe it would be unfair.
But they are certificated by the APUC, assigned the service area. But they're not regulated for economic purposes.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. On page one of amendment number one, then, maybe I'm not understanding this, it says the assembly acting for the area outside all cities in the borough and the council acting for the area in a city may regulate the service.
I think that's both in the existing bill and the existing law picked up here in this amendment.
That, in my particular case, then, wouldn't give the borough any more or less power than they have over the city.
No, that particular provision, I'm sure, is existing law.
It's new language here.
Well, I can't explain the underlining.
Mr. McBride, we're just hearing Dave, but we will have a summary done for you by the staff, and he will come back, and you're not going to have to vote on this today.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
I could not explain the underlining. This was the Senate staff's amendment as presented.
Thank you. If there's no more questions, then we'll move on.
Thank you.
Oh, we have somebody else here. I don't believe you signed up. That is a problem. If
okay.
You don't sign up, I'm going to miss someone. Yesterday we started to walk home, and there was someone that had been waiting the whole time. So we had a reconvene. Yes,
Madam Chairman, in the break, if I just might make a comment, I guess I just don't understand a whole lot of things, and some of my questioning was just to try to get a background on what we're trying to accomplish and what we're trying to learn.
It's informative. I hope there's no one in the audience that came specifically to speak to the other bills on the agenda, because you seem to be bogged down a little bit here. Is there anyone that can't come back?
We can come back.
Oh, thank you. Okay.
Since you have a pause there, you'll be considering 377 tomorrow now?
We will consider 377 and 151 on Monday in a statewide teleconference. Is that all right?
That's
all
right.
Witness it. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Clark King. I'm executive director of the Alaska Cable Television Association. I again would support the amendment that Dave talked to.
Both of them?
The second one applies only to Dave. The first one applies to us. Background that Dave gave was 100% correct. In 1980, with the Public Utilities Commission rewrite, certain utilities in the state were granted exemptions. The cable television operators of the state were granted only a partial exemption from the Public Utilities Commission. Circumstance was that that exemption was to be strictly an experiment. With a 3-year window. Now, we are currently pursuing legislation at the moment to extend that 3-year window. It has passed this body already and is currently being considered by the other body. The language in the amendment makes it necessary for the industry to approach the legislature to get that exemption into the Public Utilities Commission 4205 statute. All the language here addresses is that if you are exempt under 4205 711, that you may not be regulated by the municipality. So this is why we support the amendment.
Thank you. Are there any questions for the witness?
So if you voted against that bill, you'd vote against this amendment.
Right? You can't figure that out by yourself.
274.
274? Yes.
Any other questions?
No, but if I just might interject something. Representative McBride was stating a circumstance in his community and in the original Public Utilities Commission Act. That was known as the Ziegler Amendment.
And it was particularly...
Thank you. Lee, did you want to talk to these men, please?
Madam Chairman, Lee Sharp, City Borough, Juneau. The language that's in House Bill 170, I will have to admit to having a hand in drafting. Let's see, that's on page 77, section 70. Prior to 1980, Title 29 read something to the effect that utilities within the jurisdiction of the municipality, utilities which were owned by a corporation, a person, et cetera, could be regulated by the municipality. There's an applied exception there, which we all learned about when the Chugach case came down, that if the APUC is regulating it, you may not. Or you may not regulate it in a way that's inconsistent with what the APUC has done. But we all know that that's the law. So in 1980, we could regulate essentially whatever the APUC didn't. Then in 1980, Senate Bill 577 was passed, which with a rewrite of part of the APUC Act. One of the things that was put in was that cable television would not be regulated for the 3-year period. My understanding is that was part of this deregulation cure, or whatever the figure was going on at the time, and that cable television was something that wasn't essential. We really need not regulate it. And in fact, nobody else ought to regulate it either. The industry recognized that they merely got an exemption. Municipalities under Title 29 could come in and regulate them. Now, rather than, because Title 29 said you can regulate a utility, which essentially is not regulated by the APUC, appears that in order to ensure that municipalities did not regulate cable TV and anything else that they were deregulating under that act, they took a rather broad brush approach to changing Title 29. They didn't say you can't regulate these things we have deregulated. They said you can't regulate anything except your own utilities.
which wasn't even in the Act before. The Act now reads you may regulate municipal utilities by ordinance. It used to read you can regulate privately owned utilities. So it appears to me anyway that the legislature took an entirely too broad an approach to making sure that these two or three utilities that they wanted deregulated stayed deregulated. What we tried to do with the language in 172 is refine that so that if a decision has been made by the legislature that a certain utility ought not to be regulated by anybody, then that specific question ought to be addressed by the legislature, and they ought to make that decision. And it's perfectly rational. And it should be clear in law, and then we all know what the rule of the game is. If you go through that list of exemptions that's in 4205, you'll find a lot of things are exempt. They're described as utilities, and therefore subject to regulation, but then they take them out by exempting them. People who deliver water. People who deliver fuel oil. I think people who collect honey buckets. Certain utilities with less than a certain gross income are all exempt from regulation. Now, I don't know that by exempting them there, the legislature was saying these ought not to be regulated by anybody. I think really what the legislature was probably saying is these are operations that are too small for the APUC to be concerned about. They're generally going to be mom-and-pop operations that are not very sophisticated, and the APUC should not be that concerned with them, but not that they should not be regulated by anyone. What I tried to do in drafting this language in here was provide that a municipality could regulate those type of utilities because there may be some public interest in regulating them at the local level. In other words, the customers of those utilities, which may very well be a monopoly, can look to no one for protection if we say that municipalities can't regulate anyone. Now, that's sort of a philosophical question that I thought the legislature should deal with. Do we just mean that municipalities are not competent to regulate anybody, or should we allow them to regulate those which aren't regulated by the APUC? I think that the utilities perhaps misunderstood the intent of this language. There was no intent, certainly on my part, that municipalities be able to regulate those REAs, or the co-ops, that had opted out. They have somebody to protect them. Their own customers are the ones who control that utility, and that was the theory of the opting out, was that they need not have the APUC to protect the customers, because the customers control that utility, it's a co-op. Same thing would apply to the municipality. There's no need for the municipality to get its fingers into that sort of thing. So there was never really any intention that this language be interpreted to allow a municipality to regulate those that opted out. However, because of this language surfaced, the APUC and some of the utilities, I think, got a little disturbed about what they thought was going to happen if this were passed. I sat down with Commissioner Hall, and we worked out something which he was able to agree to was something the commission could live with. I still have this philosophical problem. The APUC's approach, as near as I can tell, is, and I hope I'm not overstating this, but it may be, municipalities really aren't competent to regulate anything. Now, that, I believe, is about their approach, is that municipalities shouldn't regulate utilities, period. They need to be regulated, the APUC ought to regulate them. Maybe that's so. Anyway, that's the approach that was taken in that substitute language that went into the Senate bill. In other words, anything that's exempt from APUC regulation is also exempt from municipal regulation. So that leaves a little area that's open between what's on the books now and what's proposed, and that, if you're not a utility as defined in the APUC Act, then you can be regulated by the municipality. Now, the second amendment that Ms. Hutchins spoke to, about allowing municipalities to extend their utilities only to adjacent areas.